everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. It's good to be back. And here we go today with an article about disinformation, which you know is rampant. And here's how to spot it. Concerns around the proliferation of disinformation and so-called fake news have gained new urgency with the World Health Organization declaring that it is an infodemic around COVID-19. And here are some key questions that you might want to consider when reading the news or when looking at social media. For example, what is misinformation versus disinformation? Well, misinformation is information that is misleading or wrong, but not intentionally. It includes everything from a factoid your friend reposted on Facebook to assertions made by officials or, yes, even journalists. Disinformation, on the other hand, is more deliberate, and it is distributed with the intent to confuse you, to disturb you, or to provoke you. It also includes plausible information, which is shared through devious means, such as a fake Twitter account. A particularly deceptive form of disinformation are deepfake videos. These with imperceptible alterations in the footage, which make it appear as though someone said or did something that he or she never said or did. Be particularly on guard during crises such as the coronavirus pandemic, which provide fertile ground for exploiting fear, for creating anger, and other emotions. Well, you might want to know how to assess the credibility of a news source. And here are a few points to consider. First of all, you want to consider standards, and then what I call show me the money, then track record, and we'll go back over these now. Standards. What information does this outlet provide about who they are, their mission, and their fact-checking process or standards? The show me the money refers to who is paying for their work and why. Is it their business model that is dependent on generating clicks? How might that have influenced the story? And the track record refers to the question of, does this outlet publish corrections to errors in stories? And does it indicate transparency and accountability? Well, taken together, these methods can offer an informed understanding of the sources that you may be using. And you might want to know how you can fact check a particular claim. Fact checking sites are cropping up all over the internet to help you do just this. Duke University's Reporters Lab found a 26% increase in such sites in just the past year. Their current list includes more than 237 fact checkers in nearly 80 countries. In order to use this, look at Reporters Lab, all one word, reporterslab.org/fact-checking/ again. You can go directly to one of these sites and search for the claim you're researching, or type the claim into the Google along with the name of a recommended site. Some sites have a place to submit a claim for their team to fact check. So if you don't find an answer regarding your claim, you can suggest that they investigate it. Well, now we come to the question of bias. Here are some questions to ask yourself as you read an article. You're asking yourself questions relating to angle, and scope, and sources, and the author. Looking at the first of these, angle, what discrete aspect of the topic does the article attempt to address? And what does that say about the news organization's priorities and or worldview? Scope refers to this. Does the article do a reasonable job of addressing all relevant points of view given the space allotted? What is the time frame, the geographical reach, and diversity of people who are included in terms of age, gender, race, cultural background, and professional expertise, as well as their political views? And with respect to sources, you are interested, who are the sources? What is their expertise? How does their background inform their approach to this topic? What is the relevant emphasis placed on each source? Who's quoted most, first, and last? So in this respect, you're looking at the structure of the article. Now, about the author. What can you find out about the author from LinkedIn, Twitter, and their bio and list of recent stories that might inform how they approach this topic? And now, lastly, we come to yourself. This might be the hardest of all. If you're reading a map and you want to follow the blue trail, but don't realize you're wearing red-tinted glasses, you might end up following the purple trail without realizing it. So it's worth asking, what is coloring the way I see this news source, this issue, or this article? And lastly, where can you find more resources on media literacy? Some good resources include the Oxford Internet Institute's Computational Propaganda Project. I should say that again. The Oxford Internet Institute's Computational Propaganda Project. The Poynter Institute's Verification Handbook. The Center for Media Literacy. The News Literacy Project. And online courses such as Fighting Misinformation, Digital Media Literacy, from the great courses and from IREX. Once you feel more media literate, you can test yourself with an online game, Factitious. It's developed by American University Game Lab to see if you can tell the difference between real and fake news. This is a fine article from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly of May 25th. You might like to read it over after you've heard it on this program. And now I think it's time for a change of pace as we look at poetry, which reminds us of our strength. When life feels difficult or bleak, where do you turn for comfort and inspiration? For many people, good poetry is an obvious choice. That's not surprising, since oral poetry predates written language in cultures around the world. Both spoken and written verse have always expressed people's hopes and fears, their desire to understand life and to connect with something immutable. Poetry is indeed something divine, wrote Percy Bysshe Shelley in 1821. Poetry is a sword of lightning, ever unsheathed, and a mirror which makes beautiful that which is distorted. Robert Frost, on the other hand, described poetry in less lofty terms. Poetry provides a momentary stay against the confusion of this world. He argued that a poem begins in delight, but it ends in wisdom. Regardless of how one defines it, poetry requires lively, memorable language that leads us to new roads of understanding. Sometimes the understanding we need most is that we are not alone in our struggles. Others have felt what we are feeling. Poetry that comforts and consoles also lifts our gaze beyond current circumstances, or it reminds us that we have the grit and the strength and the grace to persevere, just as generations before us have. If perseverance sounds exhausting or days blend together during this strange time, poetry can jolt us out of the inertia with its imagery, its metaphor, its color, and its rhythm. I dwell in possibility, wrote Emily Dickinson, who chose to live in most of her life in isolation so that she could focus on her writing. As one of Dickinson's most famous poems notes, hope is the thing with feathers Well, let those feathers lift you now. And ending this segment, we have a poem by Carl Sandburg, an excerpt from his poem, Arithmetic. He said, arithmetic is where you have to multiply and you carry the multiplication table in your head and hope you won't lose it. If you have two animal crackers, one good and one bad, and you eat one, and a striped zebra with streaks all over him eats the other, how many animal crackers will you have? If somebody offers you 5, 6, 7, and you say, no, 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 and you say, nay, 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 and you say, nix, nix, nix. If you ask your mother for one fried egg for breakfast and she gives you 2 fried eggs, and you eat both of them, who is better in arithmetic, you or your mother? We're back with you now with the question. Why birds? Why do birds do the things that they do? Or, put another way, what's it like to be a bird? Well, this is a new book out by David Allen Sibley. Alfred Knopf is the publisher. And David Allen Sibley is an illustrator and a birder of great repute. Many of us have been homebound this spring, which sharpens the joy of backyard bird watching. And in a season too often defined by isolation, the arrival of a cardinal or a blue jay just beyond the window is a hopeful reminder of continuity and connection. And even in the midst of our current troubles, it seems, nature carries on. It's in this spirit that the book, What It's Like to Be a Bird, from flying to nesting, eating to singing, what birds are doing and why. This new book from David Sibley is a primer on all things ornithological, and it's likely to find an especially receptive audience right now. Sibley is best known for the series of bird guides that he launched in 2000. Like others in the genre, Sibley guides are small enough to slip into your coat or your knapsack. But What It's Like to Be a Bird is a big coffee table book meant for indoors, meant for an afternoon with it on your lap as you tolerate a day of social distancing. The other plus about this book is seeing Sibley, a bird artist as well as a writer, to see his work on a larger scale. Like the late naturalist Roger Torrey Peterson, whose field guides defined American ornithology for generations, Sibley has an exacting eye for detail. But to accommodate the miniature format of his identification manuals, Sibley's bird pictures are usually not much bigger than a postage stamp. But in this book, though, Sibley's artwork has ample room to spread its wings. The heads of his snow geese and swans and ducks seem to approximate life size. Each one is rendered in Sibley's signature gouache technique, a variation of watercolor that shimmers with radiant color. Sibley, like John James Audubon, is especially drawn to the faces of birds, and in his renderings, as in Audubon's, they look almost human. This is a book I think that a lot of us would like to have right now, and that's why I'm talking about it. I'm going to go from that to questions of wit and wisdom to work our way towards the end of today's program with wit and wisdom in mind. I often like to end the program with quotes that I've found to be insightful, humorous, surprising. And today we have a few quotes for you. One from W.H. Auden. "The hospitals alone remind us of the equality of man." And from the journalist Sidney Harris, "A cynic is not merely one who reads bitter lessons from the past. He's one who is prematurely disappointed in the future." From the novelist Wendell Berry, "It's hard when nature does not respect your intentions. And she never does exactly respect them." George Orwell told us, "Every revolutionary opinion draws part of its strength from a secret conviction that nothing can be changed." And Leo Tolstoy has said, "The two most powerful warriors are patience and time." And finally, from Leo Tolstoy to Joan Baez, "The easiest kind of relationship for me is with 10,000 people. The hardest is with one." Well, My articles today have been from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, which is an invaluable source for this program, and also from The Week magazine, from which Wit and Wisdom is taken. And now we're ending today's program with the hope that you will take care of yourself, be kind to others. I hope you enjoyed today's show, and be with us next time, because I do like to think that you're coming back time and time again. Goodbye for today.